One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 14th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor of Philosophy from the University of Delaware, David Blacker, on the falling rate of learning and the neoliberal endgame. Also on the program today, budget deal struck. The age of austerity continues. Chris Christie still in hot water, and the pot is actually getting bigger. More hot water. The cleanup continues in West Virginia. Not clear how many now in West Virginia still not able to drink their water, bathe in it, brush their teeth in it, use it for anything other than disposing of waste. That number has been as high as 300,000 people. More privatizing the profits and socializing the costs. Over the weekend, we celebrated, or I should say, marked the one-year anniversary of the death of Aaron Swartz. Meanwhile, Republicans, more of them now, disbelieve the theory of evolution. They are devolving, if you will. And an Oregon Republican county group has a very interesting way of celebrating Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln's birthdays. And today, hopefully, in the funner half of the program, we will get to that Frank Luntz new developments, though, in that story. So
it's pretty timely. We'll get to it.
And want to say thank you to listener RP, who sent Matt and Michael and I out to a sushi dinner last night in New York City. We are all well-fed and brimming with some wonderful fish to celebrate the new year. So thank you to you, sir. Very generous supporter of this program. Before we get to Professor Blacker, this just in, the D.C. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., I should say, has struck down the FCC's net neutrality rules, which prevent companies like Verizon and other internet providers from favoring some type of internet traffic over others. So maybe Verizon will be pushing its own music service, or on and on and on. The ruling was 2-1.
Not only that, though. Any company could approach Verizon and be like, hey, listen, we'll pay you this much more.
Definitely.
To give our content faster, quicker, more access to it than, let's say, our competitors.
Yep. They have ruled because the commission failed to establish the anti-discrimination, anti-blocking rules. They do not impose per se common carrier obligations. In other words, we spoke to Marvin Amori about this, I believe it was just before Thanksgiving in November. on he predicted at that time that the court would strike down this net neutrality rule. It is because the FCC failed to reclassify internet providers properly as common carriers. The FCC has the latitude to reclassify. We don't know if they will, but as Marvin Amori said at the time, we need people to push back on this. The FCC has to develop some sort of spine. Hopefully this will activate people. We shall see. In the meantime, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor David Blacker. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, professor of the philosophy of education and legal studies at the University of Delaware, and the author. His latest is The Falling Rate of Learning and the Neoliberal Endgame. He's joining us at the moment from Cairo. Welcome to the program, professor.
Hi, Sam. Glad to be here.
So let's start with the state of education in this country and how we perceive how we perceive education and how that's changed over the years.
Well, I guess from my analysis is that over the years we've perceived education as one consistent theme has been as vocational preparation, right? So we're adding value to future laborers, to the workforce, in order to, supply enterprises of various kinds. And education has been thought of in that respect. There's also other agendas. There's a citizenship agenda that's been, advocated a lot. There's earlier agendas, too, depending on how far you want to go back. So, for example, I think the earliest, one could say the earliest impulse toward public education in colonial times, even before the United States, was a religious impulse. In fact, one of my favorite education laws it comes by the wonderful title of Ye Old Deluder Satan Act from 1647 in Massachusetts, which required towns of over 50 families, I think it was, to set up a primary school to teach literacy on the theory that, these were Puritans, Protestants, et cetera, on the theory that in order to be saved, you had to be able to read the Bible by your own light, by yourself, and not with help from a priest or so on. So there's this imperative kind of toward universal education that everyone needs to get it. So it's not all, the capitalism and so on. There are pre-capitalist, you might say, imperatives. So there are religious imperatives. citizenship imperatives, especially in the 19th century when things get going. But I think what really, really motors the imperative toward universal public education in the form that we now have it is starting in the late 18th century, 19th century especially, the need to create workers in various ways that have certain skills associated with literacy, and also aspects of behavior, habit formation, and so on that are sometimes referred to as a hidden curriculum. You know, stuff that you get from school that isn't part of the formal lesson, but that you're still learning. You know, like sitting still for a long period of time. Having kids become accustomed, and I know you have small children, right? So this is, you maybe appreciate how big this one is, being accustomed to sitting still, you know, and having your movements regulated by a clock, you know, taking directions from a manager / teacher, you know, in schools. And also things like, and in the 19th century, it's really amusing to read some of this stuff, how challenging this was. Things like showing up to work sober, you know, was a big issue, apparently. And, you know, things that we, you know, somewhat take for granted, some of us, were part of a kind of hidden curriculum that really gave impetus to the drive toward universal public education in the 19th century, sort of, roughly you could say universal primary education around the middle of the 19th century, and then at the cusp of the 20th century, extending that up to secondary education.
And so now, and when you talk about the falling rate of learning, I mean, just describe for us what that phrase means, and then we will sort of explain why you perceive this to be happening.
Yeah, and what I wanted to do is there are a lot of critiques of education, you know, from the right, from the left, from the center, from things that are perspectives that are hard to describe where they're coming from, but plenty, let's say, from the left, critiques of marketization and neoliberal imperatives and so on. And for example, Diane Ravitch, right, who you've had as a guest, and her Reign of Error and other works by her, just, you know, very much along those lines. And I'm, you know, I guess in an academic division of labor, I've been informed by those critiques and influenced by them. But what I wanted to do was try to get a sense of why, you know, why is this stuff happening? And for better or worse, my background is philosophy. So I have this sort of disease of wanting to keep pushing why questions until everyone leaves the room by myself, you know. What's the sort of large story for why this is happening? And, you know, casting around, especially after the financial crisis, 07, 08, sort of my attempt to understand what the heck's going on in education tied up with what's the heck's going on in the economy. I found the most compelling explanation, or at least a large part of the most compelling explanation for me, had to do with changes in the nature of capitalist production itself, sort of tectonic shifts at the sort of deep level, large scale structural shifts. Otherwise, I feel like in education, when we get to education, we're just kind of treating symptoms and we don't really have a sense of, you know, why things are happening. So anyway, now, casting around, the title of my book, Falling Rate of Learning, is from the Marxist theory, The Falling Rate of Profit, which has a lot of doubters out there, including on the left. It's not even really a popular theory on the left anymore, but I think recent events have ought to give it a greater impetus. And with the help of economists like Andrew Kleiman, for example, who I think does really interesting work on this and provide as an economist. Provides interesting data and so on. The falling rate of profit theory, I guess we need to be in a really tight nutshell here, is that due to, and this is in Marx's third volume of Capital, for those who want to
open their home, right?
yeah exactly, and open up their hymnal books and you know, read along chapter and verse. The basic idea is that due to changes in production, most notably automation, technology, and so on, profits, the competition drives capitalist competition, drives increasing automation, increasing, you could say, technolization of the workforce. And now the Marxists get into all kinds of technical detail about the formulae, how capital is accumulated, and the proportion of what they call variable capital, that's human capital, like the labor, and that's where education comes in, and to the fixed capital, which is all the stuff, you know, the equipment, the shop factory floor, the machine tools, all that kind of stuff. Those ratios change. But basically, as productivity is augmented by especially technological means, there's less and less profitability in the system because other firms catch on and start employing the same productivity, the same technologies, the same efficiencies. Now, in the best case, it's sort of the great advertisement for capitalist production, right? It's a win-win. We all get iPhones that keep getting better and better, allegedly. And you know, that story. But in the long run, in the very long run, and this is Marx's view in Capital, the volume 3 of Capital, it becomes harder and harder, essentially, for sort of quote-unquote normal capitalist firms in quote-unquote conditions of normal competition to turn a profit. Because
let me just stop you here, just to sort of tease this out. So long-term trends are such that you have factories or production relies more on technology, but that
and less on human labor
and less on human labor. And the reliance on that technology has diminishing returns because their competitors also adopt these technologies. And so the profits are just less and less over time.
Right. Because as per theories of labor value that could be debated, but probably are beyond our scope right now, the real profitability comes from the human part of the equation, the exploitation of human labor. And that starts to become less and less of a percentage, less and less of a factor in profits. You know, when I looked at education, and I think the sort of traditional leftist critique of education, Marxists and fellow travelers and others, is that, you know, the problem with modern education, contemporary education, is that it's exploitative. You know, it's overly vocational, you know, and other goals like citizenship education. And even if you're of a religious type, you know, those kinds of goals are swept to the side and everyone's focused on the vocational sort of product. So it's exploitative. And so it's just sort of part of being a member of a productive capitalist enterprise. You know, it's just an early start toward making yourself marketable and valuable to some firm. So it's exploitation.
And we should say that it's basically to get an education just to tee you up so that you have the skills to go and work, as opposed to enhancing you knowledge for knowledge sake, or enhancing your knowledge for the sake of being a good citizen or a good person.
Oh yeah, yeah. Forget about that stuff. Yeah, yeah. I mean, at best, those are just kind of incidental products that are maybe nice, you know, or maybe reserved for elites, right? But the real thing is to add value to capitalist production. And so it's exploitation. And the traditional leftist critique, I think, is drawing on Kant. You know, I'm a philosopher, so I have to drop these names. The idea that it's sort of almost an insult to our humanity because we're being treated as means to an end, almost sort of like slaves in a way. You know, we're not being viewed in our full humanity. We're just being viewed as potential drones, you know, in some profit accumulating enterprise. So,
and in a more grounded critique would be the sort of the corporate reform movement of education is trying to sort of bottom line all this and to measure the value of an education within the context of sort of a corporate structure.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, identify different kinds of efficiencies and increasingly sort us in more efficient, streamlined ways and to sort of deploy us in ways that maximize efficiency. Now, my critique here, what is perhaps something of a departure in my critique, is I say that's the good old days, you know, as sort of, you know, dismal as that sounds. And I was inspired, or I guess, you know, there's a, I've often been accused of a certain type of pessimism. A friend of mine called it invigorating pessimism, and I hope that's what it is. But my more pessimistic view, I was inspired by, if inspired is the right word, anyway, by a phrase from an English economist, Joan Robinson. I think it was in the 50s. She said, well, you know, we've learned that the only thing worse than being exploited by the capitalist is not being exploited by them. You know, and so being exploited, being the almost the golden era, what I call the all hands on deck era of capitalism, where the more labor, the better. Immigrants, get them in here. You know, more hands on deck, more exploitation, that creates more profits, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I think due to these changes that we mentioned a little while ago, and having to do with productivity through automation and ultimately the changing nature of capital itself, we're entering an era of what I very dismally call eliminationism, where the mass of humanity simply isn't required as much anymore for profitability for these enterprises, and so that's bound to reflect itself in our educational systems. Whereas once and that very ideal of universal education I see is threatened now, because you know I see it as, in general, not exclusively, it's more complicated than that, and I don't embrace a wholly reductionist picture. But in general, it's that that imperative toward universal education is really, I think, driven in our experience in this country, has been driven by this idea of exploitability, maximizing the ability of the most people we can get to be exploited by capitalist enterprises. But now I think we're in a situation where simply less people are needed. So in the economy.
So let's back up just a little bit here. So when we talk about this concept of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, we can see that reflected at least in our society in the increase in financialization of our economy, as opposed to sort of an economy that is based on producing actual things.
Yeah, exactly. And we know, I mean, we can get an economist to give us the stats, but we know that that's where the profits are these days, right? It's in the casino. It's in the financialization end of things. And what I think, what's interesting and I think often missed about this falling rate of profit, because a lot of profit corporations at the moment are profitable, you know, so they say, oh, where's your profitability declining thesis? Because there are corporations that are profitable. I think, and actually Marx saw this. And again, I'm not one to just, my goal isn't to defend Marx, but I'll give him credit where credit's due, is that we see the tendency of the rate of profit to fall not so much directly, I think, but we see it in a symptomatology, what Marx actually called counterforces, that we see across a range of fronts, including financialization being just one of those, but globalization itself, also just plain increasing rates of exploitation, kind of work speed ups and so on. And ultimately, I think neoliberalization itself is a symptom of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, where there's this almost desperation to make up for this lack of profitability in our grandfather's capitalism, you know, the good old competitive capitalism. And so the features of the world we see today that are sometimes conveniently labeled as, you know, neoliberalization are all counterforces that are brought about by the resistance attempting to resist this downward kind of sink on profitability.
So these are all, I mean, so when we talk about neoliberalization, when we talk about globalization, when we talk about financialization, these are all responses to the phenomena of this of profit lowering in a the rate of profit decreasing, we should say, in localities, I guess, and in more productive activities.
Yeah.
And
right. And just in productive competitive capitalism. So, you know, and even in the financialization area, we decreasingly see investments in any meaningful sense, you know, where the idea is you're investing in productive enterprises. It's more just betting, really.
Right.
You know.
Right. And in the same way, I mean, if we were to sort of take that dynamic that the rise of neoliberal economics, the rise of globalization, And of course, technology has allowed us to do a lot of this, and the rise of financialization also sort of abetted by technology. But the impetus to turn to those, to head down those paths, I guess, is a function of the lack of profits or the lack of increasing profits in the sort of world, the capitalism that we knew. And in some ways, the corporate reform movement that we see within education as a response sort of parallels that same sort of dynamic, right? I mean, that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, education by and large, and there are islands of autonomy, and I wrote a really long and a book about that before this one, about institutional autonomy. There are ways education can depart sometimes, you know, but by and large, I think the education system of society services the economic system, you know, so that's what we have. And so it's no surprise, maybe with a little lag time and so on, especially in the rhetoric. It's not surprising that we would see these developments reflected in the education system. And I see kind of the various sort of assaults on education, including on public education that we see currently, as reflective ultimately of this process. So, you know, if there's less need to for so many people to exploit in the economy, I think it's reasonable to predict that we're going to see less enthusiasm among elites for the very project of universal education. You know,
now that's, that's, comes in that comes in the form of two things. One, we see a less of a public investment in education. We see it on a higher education level. I mean, this is borne out by statistics.
Yes. So we have austerity for one. Yeah. For starters, austerity. Yeah.
And we can see that in the form of less funding for higher education by states and by the federal government, and sort of shifting to a sort of a loan based type of support for higher education, as opposed to simply providing it and paying for it directly. We see it.
So it's on to the individuals. It's on to the individuals rather than state support in higher ed. Yeah, exactly.
And that dynamic also is a function of this notion that you must now calculate the worth of an education in very narrow terms. In other words, a college education is only worthwhile if it provides you X times return on your investment.
Yeah, it's you know the game of life. You remember that game, the board game of life? You know, when you play that game, you got to make that calculation. Do you want to go to college? You know, do you want to have kids? I try to stay out of college and not have kids in that game. Actually, you know, I feel like you turn out ahead, but you have to make these calculations. It's a pure personal investment, and you're predicting the future returns on that investment. And you know, universities are only, including my own and all others, are only too happy to trot out statistics about how you'll earn more over the lifetime, you know, with a college education than you would with a high school education and so on. So on one level, it becomes this purely personal investment. Whereas in previous generations, and again, I'm not one to hearken to some golden era, but I think there was a little more sort of holistic rhetoric. Say in the 19th century, when we were setting up land grant universities, there was a pretty robust sense of the public good.
Even when you look at it in terms as crass as Henry Ford, right? That, you know, I want to pay and invest in my workers because they're going to drive my business. That dynamic has sort of broken down.
Yeah, kind of an enlightened egocentrism. You know, we don't get the enlightened part so much from our elites these days. And you know, those land grant colleges, the sense that you know, if I'm a farmer, you know, out in wherever, and I live on a farm, I kind of get this. You know, why should I care about what's going on at the state university? Well, it's because these bright young fellows from the agricultural extension showed me some cool stuff about fertilizer. You know, to help me, become more productive, and you know, it seemed worthwhile. Like there was a sense that we're kind of all in it, that we all benefit from an enlightened populace. And there's also enduring Jeffersonian ideals of an enlightened citizenry that you need for a democracy. But you know, when it comes down to it, I think that economic kick is really what does it. But I think these days there's a decreasing sense that a general diffusion of knowledge among the population, say through higher education, and there's questions about how much knowledge is being diffused among today's undergrads, say, but a general diffusion is there's a decreasing sense that that actually benefits the public as a whole rather than benefits A, elites, I think, specifically, and B, just those individuals themselves. You know, so right. It's harder to make an argument to that farmer for why he should or she should pay taxes, you know, to support the local state university in order to support this kid who's going to be the sole beneficiary of the credential rewards that that kid is receiving. So it's kind of it's a more crabbed sort of vision. It becomes just another commodity.
How do we see that credentialism or that commodification in the context of elementary school and junior high and high school? I mean, how does it manifest itself there?
Well, I guess what I see, and you know, my general thesis here is that, I mean, I think what we see is a general waning in the commitment to this whole project of universal education itself. And so if we're talking about K through 12 schools, we see it reflected in, along several fronts. One, kind of we talked about before, austerity, I suppose, just kind of it's always a budget squeeze, you know, always a budget squeeze. It's always doing more with less. And that's kind of what we have. We also see, and I have a chapter that deals with this just because I happen to know something about it. I think so. We see a decreasing patience with students' rights and students' expression, as reflected in some recent Supreme Court decisions and a general sort of societal mood that. You know, these kinds of things are less important because they speak to development of the whole person and sort of, you know, proto-citizens, you know, exercising free speech in schools. The purpose there is that they're going to become citizens. And if we want citizens to be able to robustly exercise free speech, they need at least a little of that in schools. And so I think we see, you know, due to certain legal developments and also some of the terrorism stuff feeds into this safety, you know, concerns. We see a decreasing patience with student expression in different ways. Also, I think we see a willingness to kind of compromise when it comes to things like compulsory education. But in some ways, I think you could argue the biggest thing is that I think increasingly we see a kind of disciplinary environment in schools, you know, where many schools, especially in certain areas, seem to be much more designed for surveillance and warehousing and, you know, the so-called school to prison pipeline and all that stuff. I think it's that, you know, so my argument is not that the schools go away, that they get eliminated, you know, the buildings are there and they're still called schools, but I think their nature starts to change underneath everyone's feet.
And we see that also in the way that the ability for teachers to develop their own curriculum becomes narrowed so that they are doing something that is very specific and supposed to have the most value to society as making, you know, it's almost as if the sort of and I keep hearkening back to this a little bit, but this corporate reform movement is to squeeze the last value out of a diminishing number of students and a narrow value out of them.
Right. And along with that, just adding fuel to that same fire would be privatization across the board, which we see especially in higher ed, but now sort of coming to a public school near you, you know, a public K-12 school near you.
I think we have like 20 times the amount of charter schools in this city, in New York, than we did at the beginning of the Bloomberg administration.
And Delaware, where I teach, is big on those too. And of course, that's all premised on a kind of invisible hand model. You know, it works so well for the banking industry. Surely it'll work well for the school system.
And so let's get into that theory of eliminationist. I mean, tell us what that means, and then within this context.
Well, eliminationism is, you know, I mean that it's somewhat of a hyperbolic because I'm trying to kind of shake people by the scruff of their neck, you know, and pay attention. It's drawn from a very dark context, which is the context of Holocaust scholarship and historians like Daniel Jonah Goldhagen, who, you know, analyzing the Nazi hierarchy and their debates over the quote unquote Jewish problem, you know, at the Wannsee conference and so on, there were the, you know, this also, by the way, gives you an illustration of how parameters of discourse can be quite narrow to the vanishing point, where the sort of progressive side wanted to work people to death, right? And the other side wanted to simply send you straight to a death camp, you know, without the exploitative moment. And so of course, that's, you know, an extreme. And I'm not saying our schools are Treblinka, you know. But I think the kind of the structure, the logic, the structural sort of moral logic is similar, where we've moved from exploitation to this posture of elimination with regard to our own, you know, young citizens, because they're no longer needed in the same way.
And so
yeah,
and they're no longer needed as to be educated in many respects, right? I mean, it's the
whole
ideal of an educated population that is being eliminated less than the actual population.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and that has ramifications for democracy and the sustainability of a democracy and so on. But you know, in the 90s, there Robert Reich, his book, I forget the title of it, the vision was this kind of sunny vision of we'll all be knowledge workers and doing all this creative stuff. And the answer is more education, you know, more education. Well, I'll tell you, I think that's true for a tiny, tiny sliver, you know, the people who get the good jobs at Google maybe or whatever. But you know, compare Google to River Rouge and, you know, and the numbers employed. But you know, that's available for a time. For most of the population, I think a dirty little secret about technology and education, you know, where the assumption seems to be that the more technologized the society are, the higher educational demands are and the more we need educated workforce. Well, I think very often it's the opposite. You know, a simple example would be, you know, when I was a kid, we had cash register. When I had like a fast food job, we had cash registers where you had to like count change back to people, you know, and stuff, and actually do a little math. Right. Now the cash registers that they dispense the change automatically, and they're high, much more high tech, but they require less skill. You know, change is dispensed less skill and nudge. Change is dispensed automatically. I think you don't even have to know when to stop when you pour the medium-sized Coke. You know, you just press the icon, you know, and it does it for you. So there are all these areas where, you know, it's sort of a fallacy, I think, to think that the higher tech society requires higher levels of education. I think that's true for just a shrinking sort of sliver of sort of a managerial class that's becoming fewer and fewer, where the rest of us are – well, I guess I'm a professor in a university. Maybe I'm part of that sliver, you know, vanishing sliver. But where most all of us are then condemned to a situation in which those, you know, any skills we might have are simply irrelevant. We're just kind of like wards of the state, just not even really needed anymore.
So what is that neoliberal end game then?
Well, first of all, I guess I want to clarify. For me, neoliberalism actually doesn't exist. You know, it's more of a rhetoric. It's sort of like capitalism's PR department, you know, because it's more of a rhetoric. I mean, so I actually think neoliberalism is simply a kind of rhetorical justification for what's going on. So, for example, with neoliberal rhetoric across the board in education and other areas, we have a huge, you know, like obeisance to competition. You know, competition, got to get more competitive, and markets. We got to have more markets. Everything's got to be marketized. However, I think behind the scenes of that, what's really going on, the elites are sitting back and they're in monopoly positions where they're essentially rent collecting. You know, so competition is for the little people, right? And, you know, we have too big to fail banks. We have, you know, everyone, you know, the elites are consolidating themselves into monopoly positions and using this sort of rhetorical club of neoliberalism for those who still sadly believe in things like competition and marketization, and you know that's the way to go. So first of all, I think neoliberalism is kind of this fictional sort of rhetoric. Like I said, it's sort of like the Madison Avenue of today's capitalist class, I think. You know, too bad for us if we continue believing in it. Because paradoxically, in this so-called neoliberal era of competition, we're getting more and more monopoly. You know, that's where the money is. And that's where the political power is. So I guess I'd say that first. And so to me, the end game has to do with, societal collapse, because, you know, due to factors we haven't talked about yet, There are internal tensions, I think. I don't think this system is economically sustainable because of these internal sort of tensions having to do with profitability. But I also think there are externalities having to do with the environment, you know, and also potentially energy, what's sometimes called energy descent and a resource depletion across the board. These sort of externalities, you know, the external factors that are needed for the production, the energy factors, and also the externalities in the sense of the effects, you know, like on pollution, climate change, you know, et cetera. These things don't tend to get factored in to sort of neoclassical economic models. And so run this whole machine forward. And I think there are three sort of distinctive, I've taken to calling them the three horses of the apocalypse. You know, the economic, you know, the economic tensions, climate change, and then the energy problems, and resource depletion problems. And so we're kind of sitting here captive watching this really unpleasant horse race. You know, any one of those horses will be quite sufficient to do us in. And I grew up in Kentucky, and the horse races were a lot more fun there than that one.
Well, yeah. So I mean, so you've got these three horses of the apocalypse, and they're not, but they're not necessarily directly related to learning. I mean, the learning is in some ways,
They're not. Except
the fall in learning is symptomatic of what of a problem that is in some ways, I guess, explained by the other by the three horses.
Yeah, they're symptomatic, and I think the education system doesn't have a lot of agency. I think educators, naturally so, kind of like to, you know, puff themselves up and sort of a little cheerleading, understandably so, to feel that they have a lot of agency. You know, you can do it, you can pull yourself up, we can change the world through better education, and so on and so forth. But I think that's all illusory. You know, I think there's not a lot of agency there. You know, it might be good for individuals who might scramble on the lifeboats that are getting smaller and smaller, you know, by education. So if I want my own kids to maybe try to get on that lifeboat and beat the other people off of it, I guess. I don't know. But I think overall the education system isn't really a motive force here. I don't think it has. I think it's more of a kind of marionette of these larger forces. Like, so for example, and not just the economic forces, like if we look at, you know, energy, for example, in the United States, especially, our whole school system is set up on the assumption of cheap oil, cheap energy, right? We have these large sort of catchment areas that are, we run by, where we get kids to school by bus transport, you know, to factory schools. We have buildings that are only inhabitable with HVAC systems, you know, that require, you know, a lot of expenditure and sort of assume cheap energy, like multi-floor school buildings in Houston, where I also grew up, and in places like Miami. And they're simply not habitable. So I think even the structure of the institutional sort of forms of schooling in this country are sort of, you know, right on the edge in various ways that aren't always appreciated.
So we don't have too much time left, but let's get to the invigorative part of the pessimism. So where does that leave us? I mean, if this is the road that we are headed down, and what we're seeing, this fight, let's say, in the education sphere between sort of corporate reformers and those who want to maintain education as something that should educate, you know, the person for a broader set of reasons than just to function, to be exploited, and is still in some ways holding on to the notion that they all can be exploited rather than just sort of like, we're going to pick out a few of you to be exploited.
Happy vision is universal exploitation. Let's get back to that.
Right.
That
I mean, yeah. So where does that leave us? I mean, do we need to, I mean, I think you talk a little bit about sort of on some level, it's about biding our time until the playing field changes because one of those horses of the apocalypse shows up and changes the playing field.
Yeah, and I think our best I think our best chance is, you know, Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, right, where it sort of sees the crisis, the right wing tends to seize the crisis. I think, you know, we maybe a little progressive lower left wing shock doctrine thinking is in order, where and frankly opportunistic thinking, because I don't think the good guys are going to win in terms of school reform and all that. I think that system is fated to go down. I mean, there's some nice rhetoric. There's some nice oppositional types that I, you know, their parts are in the right places. But I think that system's going down. And so to me, I think the invigorating part, and my last chapter.
I was going
to
say, incidentally, this is our last program.
We're going to just just wrap it up and, you know, wait on a beach somewhere.
Right.
But my last chapter is entitled Fatalism, Pessimism, and Other Reasons for Hope. I mean, how about if we think about it this term? I think part of it, you know, because I'm focusing on educational institutions, and I think it's sort of target selection for the left, so to speak, right? I think it's really a waste of energy and a waste of time to put our hopes in the idea that we can reform schools, these institutions that we have as they're currently constituted. Because I think they're really fated. And I defend a certain notion of fate that I don't think means that things are foreordained in the future, but that certain institutions, just like certain individuals, can kind of be oriented in a certain direction. And it's right. Really, really hard to set them off course. But there's always chance. I mean, I guess let me end. If we're close to finishing, let me just say, I mean, think about, think about natural selection, right? I mean, a random mutation can occur. There can be unforeseen mutations that occur. There can be unforeseen environmental events that occur. And I think, you know, if history's any guide, there will be things that we don't see in the future that we can't predict. So I think, if we extrapolate simply from present trends, that's where I don't see a heck of a lot of hope. I think we need something that's unanticipated at present to actually change course. And I would love, there's a really powerful tendency, and I get this all the time, especially from educators who like an activist, right? Activists, as the name suggests, they want to be active. You know, what can my agency do? What can my agency do? And if you're giving me a picture where there's no agency, then because it makes me feel bad psychologically, I'm going to reject that picture. Well, I think maybe that picture that we have itself could be the problem. You know, that we have this sense that we can always fix things through a kind of technological sort of fix. And I think, oddly enough, paradoxically, there could be some sort of answer in our sort of letting go of that kind of assumption.
We should say that, you know, you say that from the perspective of a philosopher, yeah. to be fair, but I mean, on some level, it also sort of says it's incumbent upon us to, be ready with prescriptions and to be opportunistic when the opportunity arises.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, small scale experiments in terms of pedagogy, I'm completely enthusiastic about those. So islands of progressive pedagogy and progressive schooling. I visited Summerhill School in England, which is sort of famously progressive school where students make the rules and so on. And I thought it was an absolutely wonderful, wonderful place. What I'm pessimistic about is the idea that these things are scalable, right? That they can be sort of the blueprint, the template for making over the whole system in general. That's what I want to throw cold water on and what I want to be pessimistic about. What I want, though, what I want is for those kinds of experiments to somehow just endure, you know, not on the hope that they're going to become the norm and they're going to scale, you know, everything according to themselves, but that they're going to be there lying in wait opportunistically, you know, in a shock doctrine sort of situation in which all of a sudden we're going to be looking around for different models because what we've been doing on this large scale simply is not possible anymore. And so it's going to be extremely valuable to have these models around. And I think the same thing about things outside education, sort of like, say, like permaculture.
Right.
In terms of, it's not that everything's going to become permaculture. Agribusiness is going to suddenly see the light and become, but I think, given the unsustainability of these modes of agriculture, these permaculture experiments, organics and so on, these are going to be extremely valuable head starts to have around when they're really the only live options that we can turn to.
Well, Professor David Blacker, the book is The Falling Rate of Learning and the Neoliberal Endgame. Fascinating stuff. Invigoratingly pessimistic, but but also, again, just really fascinating, and really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. And it's important to keep a sense of humor. I should throw that in.
Indeed. Well. we're just about to move into the funner half of the show.
All right, where we'll be.
Yes, but
all right, all right.
We'll excellent. Put a link to your book on majority.fm, and thanks so much for your time today. Really, genuinely appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, and keep up the great work. I love your show.
Oh, well, thank you. All right, take care, folks. Bye bye. All right, folks. Wow, I mean, fascinating stuff, and to a certain extent, I hope that at least some of that is wrong, but it is still incumbent upon us to fight the good fight and sort of push these ideas around. And, you know, it also reminds me of the conversation we had with Bhaskar Sunkara, who talked about socialist ideas being developed sort of in an intellectual realm, but in the meantime, working towards any type of incremental change simply because you are some change is better than no change, and you're developing relationships and spreading sort of ideas during that time. I mean, you know, I mean, it's incumbent upon me to say that so that we do show up tomorrow for work, and you continue to tune in. I should also say that it's also incumbent upon you to become a member of the Majority Report. To also aid us in our ability of showing up tomorrow and continuing the work we do here. You can become a member at majority.fm. Very easy to become a member, and very sustainable. 33 cents a day to bring you interesting guests, fascinating conversations, sometimes some modicum of humor for which to lighten your day, and entertainment as well, I hope. You can become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support this show by going to majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. If you buy any crap through Amazon, you simply go to majorityreportkickback.com. You click on the link. You bookmark it. You always buy your Amazon crap through there. So if you were to go and pick up the professor's book, Falling Rate of Learning in Neoliberal Endgame, click on that link, you bookmark it. That's your Amazon site. You go there, you'll notice no difference. But when you purchase that book, we get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate.
You can also support this show by picking up our next dinner tab.
Right. 10% coupon code on that coffee. Also, you can support the program by giving us a good review on iTunes or signing up for our Donate Your Account to retweet our stuff automatically. Matt, you've been on that, right?
I've been on that, yes.
And on Facebook, too. So go to donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. Tell your friends. The app is a great way to share the show. It's a great way to share the show. You just tell them, get your app. Whatever, you got a smartphone, get the Majority Report app. It's free. People start to become casual listeners.
And if you got the app and haven't left a review for it, leave a review for the app.
By all means. All right.
It's two things you're reviewing, the podcast on iTunes and the app in the App Store.
Indeed. We've got the phones fixed today, 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, you can IM the show through Majority FM on AIM or through the app. Tomorrow on the program, Tom Philpott from Mother Jones. And we'll be discussing GMOs.
Oh,
and not
goody.
Just GMOs, but our industrial food supply. That I am making a prediction that tomorrow's program will elicit as much or nearly as much
nearly
controversy
as much.
And feedback as our legalization of marijuana program from the other day.
Yeah.
It'll be close.
We'll see.
I think I just wanted to add that the professor was joining us from Cairo. Did you say that?
Yes, I did.
Oh, in the beginning.
I have to say,
I don't know
what they're doing with the internet over in Cairo, but man, that call was clearer than most of our calls from people in America.
That's right. We invite all of our libertarian friends to head to Cairo to use yes. the internet connection there. Because they can't seem to. We'll also, in the funner half of the program today, talk about some of the stories we mentioned earlier. Hopefully we'll get through Frank Luntz. If not, it's a long week, folks. We'll get there. I promise you. Frank Luntz is not going anywhere.
Teasing this Frank Luntz
yeah.
story.
But this West Virginia stuff is just stunning. I mean, I want to hear from a libertarian who believes that there should be less regulation. I saw Glenn Beck tweet something about a picture that a lawmaker sent him about. We've become a nation of regulations. Well, there was a big regulatory gap with this Freedom Industries and their storage of this wildly toxic chemical, method, blah, blah, blah. I can't even name. I don't even, MHMH or something. And not only did this leak and just dump into the Elk River, which was a source of drinking water for these people in West Virginia, but they didn't even, they weren't the first ones to report it. Like literally the community said, hey, something stinks. Like literally stinks.
Well, let's talk about it in the better half.
Right. I mean, as if there's no process in which for these people to realize they are dumping poisonous chemicals into the drinking supply. We'll talk about this in the funner half. Maybe we'll speculate. Like, what if a terrorist dumped, like, just even a fraction of this amount into the drinking supply? Can you imagine? We'll talk about it in the
Well, if a terrorist did it, they hated us for our freedom.
Right. Well, as a libertarian might
say. For our
say,
freedom industries.
Right.
They hate it. If, as a libertarian might say, though, if you stop the chemicals from leaking into the water, then you eliminate the ability to solve cancer. Right. Cure cancer.
Say that again?
I remember a
Save
libertarian
it for the fun
caller.
Half.
Save it for the
All
fun
All right. Half. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. We got a lot of stories to get to. Take your IMs, your phone calls. See you in a minute.